Welcome to the Empirical Cycling Podcast. I'm your host, Coley Moore. Thank you, everybody, as always, for listening. And if you are new here, please consider subscribing to the podcast if you like what you're hearing. And if you're a returning listener, we really appreciate having you back. And if you'd like to support the show, of course, the easy way to do that is to give us a nice five-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. And a really glowing review goes a long way. We thank you for all of that. And of course, you can share the podcast if we are relevant to any conversation that you happen to be having, or if you just want to share it because you like it, we really appreciate all of that. And we are ad-free, so if you want to donate to the show, your donations really keep the lights on here. We really appreciate everybody's donations for the last couple months or years, of course, and the donations that have yet to be made. We thank you all for all of those. They really do keep the lights on. We really appreciate all of that. And if you'd like to make one, empiricalcycling.com/donate is where to do it. And our ultimate Patreon, as it were, is to become a coaching client. So if you would like to hire us as coaches, if you kind of vibe with our philosophy, we really appreciate that. And you can do so by reaching out to empiricalcycling@gmail.com and starting a conversation there with me. And if you'd like to hire us for a consultation, we can do that too. We can look at your files. We can help you plan a season. We can help you do a postmortem on a season or a race or anything. We can help you plan. We can help you integrate strength training and life balance. And whatever you want to talk about, we will help you figure it out. So again, that's empiricalcycling@gmail.com. And up on Instagram, at Empirical Cycling, we usually ask some listener questions for the podcast. We did not today because I just wanted to have a conversation and really respect our guests' time because they're all busy professionals and I was just happy to have them on. We did not plan also to have any listener questions. So we didn't have any, but I do have weekend AMAs up in the Instagram stories. And so if it's usually post that somewhere around midday Saturday, East Coast time, the US. So if you'd like to follow along or you'd like to ask a question, please hang out over there. And or if you don't want to ask a question, just read along. And we really get some interesting questions and I appreciate all of them. The podcast is a little bit unusual in format for a couple reasons. The first one is that we are doing a little bit of current events, but not really, because it's a Peloton politics thing, but also I thought it was a really interesting reason to have this conversation as use this as a jumping off point for larger issues. Although we do definitely refer to it a couple times. So what happened was Kristen Faulkner got disqualified from Strade Bianche this year because she wore a continuous glucose monitor during the race. And that is illegal under UCI rules. So therefore she was punished. And we kind of get into it a little bit, but we kind of don't. The other reason that it's unusual is because we've got three guests, because after that happened, and especially with the media kind of backlash and all the hot takes and all that kind of stuff, I really wanted to have a conversation with everybody here. And I was going to just do it privately. And then I thought, okay, why don't I try to get them all together and see if we can get interesting conversation developing. And I think that we definitely did, because these are some very smart people who are all really good at what they do. And that's what we're doing here. So that's why we've got three guests. And we're talking about something a little bit current, but we're also using it to talk about some bigger issues. And the other thing to note before we get into this really is that in the conversation, we don't really spend too much time discussing the underrepresentation of women in research and in sport and all that kind of stuff, because we all kind of already know. We dig into a couple examples of stuff, and because one of the things that happened in the wake of the Faulkner thing is that it became part of the backlash about, you should be able to use it because it's a women's health issue. And we talk about how it's a women's health issue and how it can help women's health, but also how it can't. And I think that's the level of nuance that I was hoping to get out of the conversation, and we kind of did, but maybe it wasn't great because it meant that all of my hot takes are now kind of it depends again. And so, because I learned a lot from this one. And I think it's, all of our guests did a great job today. I think they had great conversation, and I really, really appreciate all of them. So let's introduce them and let's get right into it. So we've got, to start off with, a new guest to the podcast. We've got two returning. So we have a public health PhD and an MPH and also an adjunct professor of epidemiology at Brown University. This is Tracy Carson, and she has also done research on low energy availability in women and chronic stress and things like amenorrhea, loss of periods, and loss of bone mineral density and stuff like that. So So she's here because of that, and she's great. I hope everybody enjoys her first appearance here. I hope we have her back again. We also have returning Nemrita Brooke, who is our guest for nutrition and stuff. She is the person I recommend all of our clients to for nutrition coaching and all that stuff. She's a registered dietitian and also a cycling coach herself. And she's really no slouch around all this stuff. And she was great on the podcast as usual. And especially because everybody gave us such great feedback about her last time and the time before. I'm happy to keep having her back on. So thanks for everybody for all the kind words for Nemrita. And she apparently got a couple kind words too. And that's awesome. So thank you, everybody. And of course, last but not least, we have Fabiano Araujo, who is an MD and PhD and a coach with us here at Empirical Cycling. So, and he and I have had many conversations about glucose, blood glucose and glucose monitors, and he's used some himself and his, some of his clients have used them. And also I thought his perspective as a doctor and, you know, in one-on-one health practitioning would be really interesting. And so that's where we're going with the conversation today. I hope everybody enjoys it, and let's get right to it. And I hope everybody learns as much as I did. So yeah, we'll see you on the other side. I think first, let's start with, okay, so we're going to focus mainly on continuous glucose monitors. One word answer from everybody. We're going to start with you, Tracy. Are continuous glucose monitors a necessity in endurance sport?
No. Necessity? No. Necessity is a strong word. I get one word answer.
Okay. Yes. Nemrita.
No.
Fabiano.
That's my one word answer.
No.
Okay. Okay. One more round. One word answer. Are continuous glucose monitors helpful in what you do in endurance sport?
Possibly.
Okay. Nemrita?
Helpful? Yes.
Fabiano?
It depends.
Classic.
That's two words. I would have said it depends if you gave me two words, but I thought I had yes or no.
That's why I said possibly. You kind of skirted the binary there.
Yeah. Sorry. I said one word. I didn't say it had to be yes or no, because that these are definitely tough questions. So anyway, so definitely what we're here talking about is Kristen Faulkner's disqualification. So why don't we start with what actually happened? Because she was riding Strada Bianchi with a Super Sapiens monitor on her arm. She said she was not recording data, but the text of the actual UCI rule is Article 1.3.006, devices which capture other physiological data, including any metabolic values, such as but not limited to glucose or lactate, are not authorized in competition. So it says pretty distinctly devices, not the recording of the data, but the having the device. So do you think that rule is fair or not? Because what we're really getting to is, do you think that there's a performance advantage knowing your glucose levels in racing? Like, Nemrita, why don't we start with you on this?
Yeah. So do we start with, do I think the rule is fair? I mean, the rule is the rule. They have a lot of rules I actually don't understand, so that it kind of is what it is. Do I think you have a performance advantage? No, absolutely not. I think what is happening is we're giving these devices way too much credit. It's like, you know, you wear a device and it says your readiness score is like green and you're ready. I mean, are you going to trust that? I hope not. and you know, an estimation of your blood glucose using interstitial glucose measurements that have a delay that are not the same as your blood glucose, that are way oversimplifying complex processes going on in your body. I hope you're not going to attach your performance to something that simple. So I don't think there's a performance advantage. I think the rule is, I don't know. I mean, I don't see the problem personally because I, again, don't think there's a performance advantage. Do I think she should have been disqualified? No. And we can dig into that later. But yeah, I mean, there's so many so many devices out there that try to oversimplify complex physiological processes. And, you know, then you look at what influences performance and fatigue, and that gets even more complicated. So I think we're really giving way too much credit to some of these devices personally.
Mm-hmm. Well, the floor is open. So Fabiano, Tracy, thoughts?
Tracy, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, performance advantage, possibly, again, I think it depends. I'm trained as an epidemiologist, so I think a lot about measurement and, like, are we measuring what we're saying is being measured? Are people interpreting those measures correctly? I think there's a lot to be left to research to really improve devices, to take the meaning and the measures and make, great sense of them. So I'm not sure these devices are always measuring what athletes think they're measuring. And then there's the interpretation of the measures. I'm not always sure the full context is there. So I think performance, an upper leg there depends on how the data is being used and interpreted, and how accurate the device is, which I think we know a lot of these devices are kind of, there's significant variability. So I think it just depends on the person, the day, the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the disqualification was probably unnecessary, but like Namrita said, we can talk about that later.
All right, Fabiano.
Well, what I think about this regulation is it's kind of senseless. They allow you to measure heart rate, body temperature, sweat rate, and these measurements can be so inaccurate. And then they don't allow you to measure glucose. Why? There is no reasoning behind this that makes any sense. And of course, when you come to performance, there are so many other variables that can be measured, and you can take advantage of this, or maybe just useless. So, and also related to the regulation is, they allow you to use it when training, but not in a race. So, what's the, and again, the reasoning behind performance there? Because I suppose, or I assume, someone that trains with a device like this when training, they will, at least that what I always try to do with data and my athletes is train their brain, their mindset to learn how their physiology works. So on the race day, they don't need the data, to just have to focus on racing itself and, of course, avoiding to look at the head units and avoiding accidents, which is then it's a good reasoning to prohibit some kind of device or looking at the screens, but not because of the performance advantage or the physiology itself, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought that power meters actually give more physiologic insight than any of these other type of monitors. And if we combine it with things like, body temperature and other stuff like that, assuming there we have accurate body temperature measurements, which we don't really quite yet. It's not quite there at the upper levels of body temp. But I think it I think kind of what the UCI was trying to go for. I'm not defending the UCI in any way, shape, or form, because I've got my own issues and headbuttings with all sorts of governing bodies, domestic and foreign alike. So I think what they're trying to do is the same thing as, like, this is probably a bad parallel, but the frame design rules, where, the double triangle, as opposed to, all the crazy stuff in the, 70s and 80s that was coming out with the, like the Lotus bike and all that kind of stuff. So there, I think it looks like they're trying to do less gamifying of racing. And I think this is sort of like they go, oh, well, if we can gamify eating, then we don't want that to happen. We want people to eat when they need to eat, yada, yada. But at the same time, it seems to me like you said, I think Namrita or somebody said this, that there's a time delay. And my impression is that once you see that your blood glucose is too low in a race anyway, you're already screwed. Am I wrong? Because, that's why you're all here. You're the experts, not me. So am I wrong here? Am I right? Well, what's going on?
Well, one, it's not measuring blood glucose. It's measuring interstitial glucose, which is related to blood glucose, but within 10% or so. And then again, you have the delay. So I think, so let's talk about blood glucose one. you're eating and drinking while you're racing, let's say, or riding. So you've got gastric emptying that has to take place. Depends if you're having sports drink, gels, chews, combination, whatever, bars, you know, it's going to slow down gastric emptying. Other things will slow that down too, like dehydration, heat stress. So the timing of delivery of the glucose into the bloodstream is dependent on gastric emptying rate. It's dependent on the absorption rate. So again, like, you know, things like we've talked about, osmolality, sodium concentration, dehydration. So there's already all these factors that go into the rate of appearance of glucose into the blood. And then now you're waiting for another, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to measure another estimate interstitially. And then glucose is being taken up into tissues, but tissues, not necessarily muscle and active muscle. Yeah, sure, some of it is, but, you know, there's also individual variability based, you know, on GLUT4 transporters and things like that, that influence the rate of disappearance or into the or uptake into the working muscle itself. So it doesn't, yeah, like, so then you think about, okay, I'm measuring on the back of my arm interstitial glucose concentration, you're not getting the whole picture. You don't know how much glycogen you have. You don't know how much of what you're eating and drinking is actually being measured through this. So if you're putting, you know, kind of all your fueling guidance, I guess, into this device, you could be, yeah, missing a big part of fueling timing and strategy, I think.
Oh, I thought somebody else had something to say. Okay. I'll follow up with, with glucose, it seems like the thing to think about is that there are multiple exits for the glucose pool that you're measuring, and there are multiple entrance points. Like the liver can provide glucose into the bloodstream. What you're eating can provide glucose, and all sorts of tissue can take it up. So if you're measuring just the bucket, like I think about this like lactate, like your blood lactate levels reflect not only what's being released into the bloodstream, but also what's being taken up. And it's very difficult to measure both of those things. Like we need some really, really invasive stuff and a lot of radioactive materials in order to really do that well. And I assume the same thing has been done with glucose, even though I haven't, that's not part of the stuff I usually read. I think my next question is, and Fabiano, I'm going to toss this over to you first. At the world tour level, wouldn't you expect most teams to have somebody who either, well, first of all, obviously knows the UCI rule, and second, is able to provide their athletes guidance on fueling such that you would probably not need it? Because in the Ruler article, which I'll link in the show notes, you know, Kristen Faulkner said, okay, I was eating, you know, a gel every 15 minutes as directed and yada, yada. And my first thought was, it sounds like she's really missing it off the bike more than on the bike. And you know, so wouldn't you expect World Tour teams to have somebody who can provide guidance on that?
Yes. That was actually a very interesting aspect of that article. And I was actually surprised by her challenges with fueling and nutrition, and also how the symptoms that were derived and signals from her health related to nutrition. And that's also known as REDS, which is relative energy deficiency in the sport. And I agree that at the level that she's racing, we would expect things like this to be under control by the team physician, the team nutritionist, and be closely followed and fixed. And it seems like, based on the, again, on the article, that the sensor, as Narita said, well, was more efficient than the team itself to help her, because, and that shouldn't happen. I mean, it should be as a tool to help the professionals to nail the diet, that what she was eating on off the bike. I agree that on the bike seems like she was doing what's recommended by the current scientific literature, but off the bike was maybe not so fine-tuned. And actually, that relates to my experience when I used CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, that off the bike was where I could see more potential for this kind of analysis, because then you have 24/7 data, and then you can really learn how your athlete eats and how the glucose fluctuates, and then take decisions that are more tailored to that athlete.
Mm-hmm. So, Tracy, Fabiano mentions RedS and you know, coupled that with that is low energy availability. And this is kind of your area of expertise. So why don't you talk a little bit about the issues around this? And, you know, what can we learn, and what can continuous glucose monitors potentially do to help?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of athletes, especially endurance athletes, tend to be, right, not to oversimplify, but pretty type A. They tend to be more on the perfectionist side of things. And a lot of people with that personality, they really like data. They like data-driven decision-making. They like their tools. They like to measure things. And I think, you know, maybe for this athlete in particular, the glucose monitoring gave her some more insights on top of these other tools she's probably using, right? Like power meter, heart rate, all these other devices that she has access to. And I think this can really be supportive for some athletes and then harmful for other athletes. I think, you know, in that article that you referenced earlier, she mentioned using the glucose monitor to try to, get her menstrual cycle back. And then now that it's back, to maintain, you know, her nutrition to support a healthy menstrual cycle, which we all know is so important, especially for female athletes. And the reproductive system for women is very finicky when it comes to nutrition and physiological stress of exercise. And it can be like this balancing act where, you know, once your period is gone, it can be really hard to gain it back, even with, you know, nutritional support from a registered dietitian, help of a doctor. And so I think some athletes are grasping for data to help them make decisions. And I think it can be supportive, but I think it has its limits. Like Namrita explained, you know, the actual reality behind glucose monitoring. And I am certainly not an expert on continuous glucose monitoring, but I am very pro, let's figure out how to support women in sport, because there's a huge lack of funding and resources that are allocated to women as it relates to what we know about male athletes. And so I see this kind of as a way that this athlete and other athletes are out here conducting their own mini experiment on themselves to try to figure out what works for them. So as a former athlete and amateur athlete currently, I can understand that rationale. And I think it kind of speaks to this larger picture of supporting research on women in sport, because then we'd have more answers and more direction for women. They might not be grasping at things like CGMs and these other devices to inform their nutrition and exercise and recovery.
So at the top level of cycling, you know, do you think that the UCI should open up the rules on continuous glucose monitoring in order to improve athlete health? Or do you think it's not necessary to do in competition? Or because, you know, like look, using data from the tour or something like that, like there's so few events in the world like that, and it's hard to replicate in training. So open question, what does everybody think?
Yeah, can I say something?
Please.
So I think, you know, if you look at the literature, we can see that just a few days of low energy availability can decrease resting or fasting blood glucose. So the problem with that is a lot of, again, complex things are happening in the body in response to low energy availability, prolonged energy, low energy availability. So, you know, longer than a week, longer than a few days in a row, even. But the problem is this device, a continuous glucose monitor, has not yet been validated as kind of a proxy for low energy availability. Lower resting blood glucose is just one, again, you know, kind of consequence of it. And we don't know that it's necessarily the total calories that's causing that. It could be just low carbohydrate intake, excessive exercise relative to energy intake. So we don't know that we can just fix it by, you know, X, Y, or Z. So I think one, it has to be validated first before we can say, okay, this is a tool, but how do we get the research to validate it? Yeah. I think making it available, for these athletes in competition is a good start for the reason that you just said. It's really hard to replicate, these demands on the body during training. You know, there's also a difference if you are specifically interested in the elite athlete. There's a difference in blood glucose control in recreational versus elite. Now, a recreational athlete will have many more glucose excursions compared to a highly trained athlete.
What's a glucose excursion?
So, like,
you take your glucose outside?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe Fabiana has a better term for it, but it's like the deviations from kind of baseline in your blood glucose monitoring over like a 24-hour period. Mm-hmm. But a recreational athlete will have many more of those fluctuations compared to a highly trained athlete, even though the highly trained athlete is taking in a lot more carbohydrates. So it's not just about the carb intake. But I think that we do need to learn more about these processes, and this is one part of it, you know, and how it can impact low energy availability and athlete health at all levels. Mm-hmm.
Tracy, Fabiano, it looks like you were both bubbling over with thoughts, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I just think that allowing athletes to wear and use continuous glucose monitors, I don't see why that needs to be banned personally. They have these other devices they're using. I understand like not wanting to be distracted during competition, but collecting the data during competition, it's like, you know, I always think more data is better. But I mean, that has limitations. But if we're trying to understand more about this topic, how do we do so without collecting data? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I know Kristen Faulkner was asked by UCI to present research to support why she needs to use her glucose monitor, but it's like that data doesn't exist. So somebody, until it does, you know, it's this kind of like back and forth relationship of like, we can't prove it's needed without the data, but there's no data to prove its, you know, utility yet. So mm-hmm. What do we do about that?
Okay. Fabiano?
Yeah, one interesting aspect of all this talk is research itself. I mean, we've been looking over glucose and diabetes for so long, and now we have these sensors that should be an improvement for care and for prevention. But the research, if you look at PubMed, for example, and you type continuous glucose monitoring and endurance training, there are only 16 papers. And that's with a trend last year. So it's really limited to the amount of data that we have. And but on the other side, one positive thing that I found on my research when preparing for here is they have a big research project that's Fendura. I don't know if you heard about it. It's based on the Arctic University of Norway, and it's targeted on female endurance athletes. So they already have a few publications out of this research project. And then hopefully in the near future, there will be more decisive and informed-based papers that will help us. For example, I did another research on glycemic control and menstrual cycle. And I only was, on PubMed, our reference for database on research. and I was able to find only 26 citations. So again, that's very limited research on looking at this point at females and how the glycemic control changes with during the menstrual cycle. And that's a big part of what was discussed in her article, that we don't have enough evidence or good evidence to discuss that as needed. And we need more data. And hopefully the UCI is just the starting point, allowing it in the races. Another aspect that I would like to pinpoint is the availability of these sensors. For example, one of the top players is mostly for CGMs. It's available only in Europe. So you have a hard time getting these sensors. And something that's also related that I was considering, these sensors are not cheap. So unless you are sponsored by a company that's selling them, and then on the race day, you say, okay, you can use on the race day. And then all of a sudden, you have an expensive sensor that you have to remove and discard. That makes no sense. So again, things are need to improve. I think, in my opinion, they should be allowed on race, at least to collect the data. And then finally have the evidence. I don't understand why they allow sweat rate, temperature, core temperature sensors, and they don't allow the glucose sensors on the UCI races.
One of the things that that I saw in reading a bunch of articles is that a lot of people said, you know, low energy availability and red S used to be thought to be associated with low body fat percentage. And now I think everybody's saying, okay, it's low energy availability, like as in how many total calories are you taking in versus how many are you spending, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't see that. I saw it's related to your blood glucose. So is this strictly true or is this marketing speak? Because a lot of what I saw just before I talked to anybody, my first thought was this is all cynical marketing stuff. Like they're advocating for using the sensor, you know, and relating everything to blood glucose levels when I think the bigger picture is low energy availability. So how much of the, the reaction to this is like Super Sapiens marketing versus how much is genuine, like we need this. Cause to me, if I saw that everybody said, we don't have enough research, we're doing research on this, we need this data because this is for women's health, I would say, yeah, like go get it. But, you know, it doesn't seem like that's been the pitch. So what's everybody's thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, if we're thinking specifically about REDS and, you know, the menstrual cycle, I mean, that there are different types of stressors that can affect the menstrual cycle, you know, with or without low energy availability or REDS, whatever you want to call it, the interchangeable term somewhat. But nutritional, psychological, and physical stressors can all interrupt the menstrual cycle, right? People who don't exercise can have an interrupted menstrual cycle. There's lots of reasons that can happen there. I think this, like, newer interest in glucose, right? Like Fabiano said, he looked at PubMed and, right, would you say 26 hits? So I don't know that there's enough there to make a strong claim that that's the only reason we're seeing low EA and menstrual cycle disturbance. I think the marketing part of it is interesting. As far as I know, Super Sapiens is not FDA approved yet. So I think it's only used, every athlete who uses it now has to be part of a trial, I think, because it's not approved yet. So maybe it's like future marketing or, you know, marketing for glucose monitors in general, but would love to hear everyone else's thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, if it was only about blood glucose, we would just tell people to eat Frosted Flakes all day, right? I mean, yeah. That's clearly not, it's much bigger than that. It's like Tracy said, you know, it's psychological. It's there's, you know, sleep affects it, stress. And, you know, eating habits in general, you can have disordered eating practices or under fueling relative to your training. Not eating enough fat, not eating enough protein, not timing your intake appropriately. So I think Fabiano said this earlier, and I totally agree when I said, are CGMs useful in my practice? Yes, because it's an interesting look at nutritional intake and individualized response to different foods and combinations of foods and timing over a 24-hour period. So how can we make improvements in dietary intake that are reflected maybe in blood glucose or glucose, interstitial glucose, but also affect how the athlete feels? You know, are they feeling more energetic, less fatigued? Are they feeling a sense of hypoglycemia or not? And so kind of relating it, you know, to athlete feelings, performance on the bike, recovery, all sleep quality, all those sorts of things I think are useful. But is it, should we be marketing this tool as the solution for low energy availability? Absolutely not. Again, it's way oversimplifying a complicated issue. Mm-hmm.
Fabiano?
Yeah. Narita said very well when she described this topic as complex. And as, again, we don't have all the answers yet. But having the CGMs, I think it will be another tool to monitor the input. At least one of the inputs would might be the glucose intake, carbs intake. And then we will start to build a better and more complete view of that athlete and try to understand if there is something that's very specific to related to that athlete together with other tools like diaries, blood tests, and analysis of microbiomes to understand what might be dictating the output, which in this case is rats. But the input is a really complicated process because we have so many variables that, as Tracy and Narita said very well, that can change the outcome, the output. And then that's why we have the professionals that specialize in treating these disorders and work with maybe coaches and dog sports medicine, all the team, the professionals that take care of especially elite level athletes to give them the best possible answer to this and not just CGMs.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we pull it back a little bit too? So, because, you know, this is such a problem in endurance sport is, you know, just people not eating enough. I can't put a finger on the exact number for my clients who have definitely suffered from not eating enough chronically. But it's gotta be at least half, at least. And you know, at some level of time or other, like whether it's a couple of days or a couple of months or sometimes even a couple of years. And I've actually lost clients who were always butting heads. I'm like, you need to eat more. And he's like, no. So, and I'm like, well, you can't do the training. And he's like, all right, well, I'm going to go train myself. And you know, it's been a problem. So what do we do? That's, you know, the 10,000 foot view, like that has, you know, CGMs and glucose in it, but like, what's the bigger picture and what's the bigger solution here in terms of, you know, what glucose monitors are trying to do versus what's the larger picture of what can we do?
Yeah. I'm really glad you brought this up because, you know, we can talk about devices and measurements all day, but there's like a much bigger, like socio-cultural, impact on nutrition and just fueling, especially, you know, if we talk about women in sport, of course, men in sport too. But, you know, for women specifically, I did one of my dissertation projects was all about like what influences endurance athletes, especially women, around their body image, fueling, all these things. And it's complicated as a woman, you know, if we're just speaking about women here. There's a lot of pressures to be a certain size, present a certain way, you know, just as a woman in society, but then especially as a female athlete and balancing almost this impossible balance of eating enough to get stronger and train and continue to improve in sport, but then also maintain this body that they, you know, may feel pressured to achieve and maintain. And then fueling for both of those things. And so I think there's a huge psychological piece that gets left out a lot when we talk about things like devices and monitors and glucose. And we have to remember like the human element behind all of it. And especially like younger women who are in this position. So just wanted to offer that perspective up too. There's like so many complexities behind just, you know, macronutrient numbers and devices and data that are really affecting athletes. And I'm sure Fabiano and Amrita, you probably have a lot of like clinical experience with that as well and can speak more to what that looks like.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going along on the same topic. I think it's super important. I think, you know, while we've indicated that there is some use for a device like this, getting it in the right hands, I think, is really important, getting the data in the right hands. So if it's not part of the coach's / team dietitian's responsibility to kind of, you know, help interpret and utilize this data for the better, for the betterment of the athlete and athlete health and performance, health primarily, I think a term that's recently come up is glucorexia. So it's, you know, people getting so over-focused on this non-physiological swing and, you know, CGM data that, you know, that can lead to bigger problems. You know, another form of disordered eating or hyper-focus on something that's not as meaningful as, you know, being in touch with overall energy intake and how you feel about yourself as an athlete and how you're fueling yourself as an athlete, for men and women. This is not, and I know we can talk about this later, this is not just a women's health issue, but I think, like Tracy said, it is a very serious problem for women and young women at a, you know, getting into any sport at a young age. Something I hate seeing, and this is really unfortunate, is, you know, there's some dietitians out there who are now using CGMs to say things like, this is why you shouldn't eat oatmeal for breakfast. Look at my, you know, how it spikes my blood glucose. And it's like, really? So I think that's the danger of having these out there in the wrong hands. Now someone like, you know, any of you helping an athlete by interpreting data for them and putting it in the context of the big picture of, you know, other practices relating to athlete health and training and nutrition and sleep and mental training and all that, you know, is a different story and can be useful. So I think that's, you know, something we also need to think about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if somebody came to me with like glucose numbers and said, what do you think of these? I would say, I have no idea. It's not even close to my area of expertise. Yeah. But Fabiano, you and some of your clients have used it. So what's your experience there in how this all fits into the big picture?
That's a great question. The experience was the first week I was, okay, I'm overwhelmed with so much data. What should I do now? And then they were, and including myself, I remember I shared some screenshots with you showing, oh, this is how my glucose is after having this meal after my workout. And then the next day I would change the post-workout meal and was comparing the spikes because in my family history, I have a tendency to have high glucose levels. So that's why I was willing to try this and see how I could improve my health and especially to prevent diabetes over time. But then looking at the Super Sapiens app, looking at the data, and there is another problem that the data is not integrated with the Fit file as it should be. You can get the data from, for example, from TrainingPeaks to Super Sapiens, but not the inverse, where I think there is more context, which is TrainingPeaks for my scenario. And then the data is separate, and then you start to work with athletes, and the data is also separate in another platform. And it's not easy to connect them because a lot of things are still under development to connect the data. And then just the fact that having access to the data was such a nightmare. I said, okay, I suggested you to try it because this athlete was also trying to improve his glucose management to avoid diabetes and gaining weight. And I said, I don't think this is really helping us. I think it's just being bringing all the complexity that Namorita said very well at the beginning of glucose metabolism. And with just one small view of the problem, which is, I mean, if you really want to dig deep into this, I would have to call your dietitian, talk to her, get your food diary. I mean, that would add so many levels of data to finally make sense of the CGM's data that I would have to charge much more for what I was charging him as a coach because of the time I would have to spend working on his data. So that's where I think the more data we have, and especially if we combine that with other kinds of input, at some point we may come up with, I don't know, maybe some machine learning or algorithms that will help us really speed up the analysis process. Because right now we have this huge amount of data, but they are meaningless because they lack context. And when you go after the context itself to get there, it's a really complex problem. I mean, there's so much information because we are just measuring one variable at this point. And then we try to add maybe workout duration, power, intensity, nutrition, the meals. But this is still just the tip of the iceberg. The problem is really complex in terms of improving someone's fate in terms of, for example, diabetes, weight management, and performance. But the data is coming, and I always optimist that as we get more and more data, just like when people start using power meters that we had no idea what to do with power, then these days we can derive so many changes in physiology, for example, just based on power, that help us as coaches and physicians to guide our athletes to their best performance. And that's where I see that CGMs will go through in the near future, or maybe in a few years.
So we're in the adolescence of using CGMs, whether they're useful or not, because I bet in a year or two, assuming that they become somewhat more popular, I think it's going to go the way of HRV, where everybody kind of might use it and then go, oh, that's interesting, and then forget about it. Because I've seen so much weird HRV data, I cannot make sense of anything. Like, the trends are weird. Like, it seems to be, when you're well-trained, it seems to be more reflective of your sleep quality than anything else. I think I want to dig a little bit more into the bigger picture stuff, because one of the things that I think this kind of stuff really reflects in our culture of endurance sport is an over-reliance on the data, as you know, pretty much everybody here has already said. So I agree there. I think it was Tracy, or Namrita, or both of you, brought up also body image, having this be in the wrong hands, because I think power data is a little bit like that too, not as much, because it's more difficult to interpret, where blood glucose, or whatever we're measuring, interstitial glucose, is much closer to general health. And I think when it comes to general health, this is where, the general population of, pre-diabetic people, diabetic people, like obese people, et cetera, where they're going to be using continuous glucose monitors a lot more. And so Fabiano, you're a doctor. So would you recommend somebody who's pre-diabetic get a continuous glucose monitor? Would it be useful? And then I'm going to toss it over to Namrita for more thoughts on this.
Yeah, there is an interesting paper that was published on Cell. It's called Personalized Nutrition by Prediction of Glycemic Response. And it's from Israel, and it's a group that did interesting research, big research of almost 800 patients. And they were studying the microbiome, blood tests, questionnaires, anthropometrics, and food diary, plus glucose monitoring. And they were using standardized meals for glucose and observing the how the glucose would fluctuate after that meal. And they, of course, they observed that people eating the same meal were having different response. So why was that? They come up with what they call the machine learned algorithm to predict the spike or the fluctuation based on the combination of microbiome, blood tests, and everything that I already cited. And after the study was done and they trained the algorithm well, they tested that same algorithm with another group of patients, another 100 patients, to see if they could improve and avoid bigger peaks or larger peaks of glucose. And in the study, they claimed they were able to achieve that. And so I was curious about that because I found it really interesting that they were able to track that down. And then I contacted the authors, and they said, one of them didn't respond, the chief. But I was able to find an app that they developed. It's already available. They call it Day 2. iOS and Android, I think. So I went to the App Store to look at how was the experience of the users to see if the app was working. And that was interesting that almost 50% five stars, very pleased, worked for me. 50% one star, doesn't work. This is that not good. So I'm glad I found that just before the podcast, because I think this helps me answer your question. So it seems like right now CGMs might be worth for 50% of the population.
Because which 50%?
That's, I don't have an answer for that, but I think we'll get to that level. And I noticed on the app that of the input they were studying, the microbiome seems to be the most important to say how a meal will dictate the glucose change.
Okay, so because we're about to get into poop samples and microbiome testing, so let's move off this topic because, let's move off the poop topic, but let's stay on this a little bit when it comes to general health, because Namrita, I'm sure you've got a lot of clients where general health is more of a big concern rather than like performance. So, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, it's so in the pre-diabetic population specifically, or let's say like older athletes who are now seeing issues and they're, you know, with hyperglycemia or insulin, hyperinsulinemia. At some point, you know, making behavior change is what needs to happen. It's not just about collecting data. It's like, okay, so regardless of whether you're measuring it or not, you've got to, you know, change your diet. So if it gets people to do that, it's otherwise sometimes hard for people to say, well, like, okay, I know I should eat more vegetables, but I don't want to, I don't like them. Or, you know, it's hard for them to get fiber. Now, maybe for them, if they can see the difference in their measures, that can help with the behavior change. That's kind of my experience. But yeah, it comes down to, like Fabiano said, you know, how usable is the data? And, but if we're talking about specific populations and health, yeah, this is absolutely an issue. You know, you can get that under control with diet, but creating long-term behavior change with diet change is very challenging. And so if this is another tool that can help some people with that, that's great.
So you're saying it's going to close the feedback loop and make it smaller, because one of the things I've noticed is back when I weighed 35 pounds heavier, I didn't feel great at all. And now I just feel like normal levels of stress in my life. And I'm totally missing all the other like kind of, God, I really feel kind of not healthy stuff. But I didn't even notice the change. So so I think that makes a lot of sense, because when you're doing fine, the things just seem to go away. Until one day you notice, oh goodness, I'm like getting up and I'm walking more, or I've got more energy, or something like that. And it's hard to notice and it's hard to focus on, because it's like the problem goes away and everything's still normal. Like your life is still stressful, you know, like that's, mm-hmm. that's never going to change. So Tracy, the epidemiologist, what's the larger public health issue? Because actually one of the things I thought you probably brightened up at was Fabiano's mention of an 800 person study, which to me is unfathomable from exercise physiology, where it's like 8, 10, I think a big study that I, the biggest study I've seen in the last like 6 months is like 35. So, where can we go with all this? And, what can we do with specifically athlete populations?
Yeah. So also 800 person study is pretty small. I'd be like, methodologists would be like, we can't do anything with that data. Like, you're so limited in scope. So I think if we're talking about the athlete population specifically, I mean, right, we mentioned this earlier. Somebody brought up just like the cost of glucose monitors. Simply not very accessible to most athletes unless it's a sponsored device or you're making a lot of money and that's not prohibitive for you. So I think we have a really long ways to go with probably research and development and showing that this is a valid tool before we'll start to see like more accessible options available, which I don't see that happening, you know, within the next couple of years. Probably it'll take longer than that, but we'll see. So I think that's the first thing to consider is just access, right? I'm putting on my public health hat. Like if there's a lack of access, it's not going to be used. We're not going to have the data. It's not going to make so much of an impact in the short term. I think, you know, if we start to do research and have the support there to look at how it does affect, you know, if we stick with this example of female athletes and low EA and REDS outcomes, I mean, that would be amazing, an additional tool for athletes who are really data-driven. Like Namrita said, behavior change is really hard. I did a master's in behavior change and all I learned was that humans don't like to change their behavior. Like that's all I learned. Sorry. Like it's all I walked away with. It's really hard to convince people, especially over time, to stick with behavior change. And for data-driven people, this might be another like helpful tool they can use. Not everyone's drawn to data in that way. So I think all this to say we have a lot more to learn and we have a lot more research and development to do to make this actually accessible to people where they can even use it. Because right now it's, I think, really far from that. You know, I've looked into prices of these devices. It's just completely not accessible at this time.
Yeah. Okay. So let me ask one last question that this is a silly question in a lot of ways, but I feel like I just want to ask it anyway, just see what happens. So do you think that the UCI, banning glucose monitors and such, do you think that this is an issue that targets women specifically, or do you think it's an issue that's broader, or do you think it's just that they don't understand what they're doing? Anybody?
Yeah, I don't know that it's targeting women specifically. I just don't think there's enough research to show that it would be targeting women specifically. We just don't know yet. I think it's kind of a silly rule. I think it seems arbitrary at this point. But I'll open it up to others.
Yeah. I mean, I've read, you know, where they don't want to turn it into Formula One racing and, you know, they want athletes to be more in touch with, you know, how they feel and whether they should be fueling and how much at what point. So I kind of get that, but I think there, like we said, you know, before, I think there's some benefits to collecting data just to understand more about what these athletes are putting themselves through and what that means for overall health during events and otherwise and during training. And when they're not training, that would be super interesting to see like what happens to a world tour athlete once, you know, once they retire or even an off season. And how does the diet and change and training load affect glucose and energy intake? I think that would be interesting. But no, I don't think that they really To be honest, it doesn't seem like they thought through all of this. And maybe they'll listen to your podcast.
What?
And...
The UCI? You're kidding.
Right?
All right. Any other general thoughts before we wrap this up?
I think the main difference between Formula One and cycling is just they have a lot of money that we don't have for our cyclists. Because as Tracy said very well, cycling is a type A sport, most of the people. They love data. And no matter what they do, people will be using these sensors, serve or not. And it's a matter of time to find out which ones are really useful or it's just like a fad. And UCI, hopefully they are listening to this podcast. They have a medical director that should be aware that it's senseless to prohibit this sensor, in my opinion.
And I honestly, I didn't really have an opinion before having this conversation, but I'm with all of you. I don't think that that it should be banned.
I mean, I will say, you know, reading the whole Faulkner saga, I feel like it truly, you know, maybe it was, obviously there was a misunderstanding. I feel like they could have done the due diligence of, you know, reviewing it through the ethics committee and deciding on an action there. I feel like if anything, a fine would have been more appropriate. To see her disqualified for that effort, I think is really sad. So I don't know. I mean, I guess there's nothing that can be done about it now, but I definitely, you know, did not think that was the right outcome.
Yeah. I don't remember if I did or not. I might have deleted this before sending it, but I may or may not have tweeted that power meters provide more physiologic insight than glucose monitors. And yet it's one of those things, you know, that did indeed stick around. It has proven useful, and it hasn't entirely gamified cycling, although back in the day, Team Sky sure made a couple tours pretty boring thanks to it. I remember they were talking about how like Nibali attacked over a climb and somebody goes, oh yeah, he's doing this many watts. He can't hold that. They were right, but it's back to being exciting kind of, thankfully.
Yeah. I mean, you're right though. Like blood glucose aside, if you don't have the glycogen and you're not fueling, you're not going to be able to generate the power. So power meters do offer, you know, I would say maybe more of an advantage too.
Yeah.
That's what I think too. I think the power meters, if they want to ban performance enhancement devices, I would ban the power meter, not the CGM.
You guys going to listen to this? Oh my God.
Sorry.
I mean, on the track, actually, the first time I ever went to the track, somebody said, you can't have your computer visible. I was like, what do you mean? Like, I can't use it? They said, no, you can have it. Like, So I didn't have like an under seat mount like a lot of people do, which is actually, you can actually look at their power if you're like riding behind them. You can just kind of look down to the side and go, oh, hey, okay, this guy's doing 500 watts right now. So all I did was I just loosened up my handlebar mount and I just flipped it underneath. And it's just, all right, keep going. It's just that they don't want you being distracted by that. And especially on the track, if anybody here is racing the track, it's very fast and it's very tight. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And I wouldn't entirely be opposed to people not being able to look at their computers. However, I think in terms of like performance and safety as an issue, I think computers are actually very valuable because people use it for how much distance they've done and knowing what's coming up and, you know, feed zone and all that kind of stuff. So I think anyway, it feels like with power meters, like the something is out of the barn. What's this phrase? The cat's out of the barn. I don't know.
I'm not good with
horses. That. Horses are out of the barn. I forget. So, somebody who didn't grow up in a city, please tell me what the phrase is. All right, everybody. Thank you all for coming on. Any other last quick thoughts before we fully actually wrap this up?
Yeah. Well, just one thing. I mean, I will say, there's no substitute for, and I think I said this on your last podcast, so sorry, I'm repeating myself, but there's no substitute for good coaching because, you know, using CGMs and looking back on glucose data from races with my athletes, all it does is confirm exactly how they were feeling. And so if they missed a feed or they dropped a bottle and they were like, you know, low on intake between two aid stations or whatever in a gravel race, you can see they, I read their race notes and I knew how they felt and they knew they were behind and you can see that in data, but we, you know, we work on developing a fueling plan before that and the training plan and the pacing plan and all of that. So it all goes together. So if you're thinking about using one, definitely seek out some sort of, you know, help to put it all together into an actual plan. Otherwise, it's not going to be that useful, I think. And you're just going to end up spinning your wheels.
Yeah. Well, it's like Tim Cusick says, it's decision science. Yeah. It's not data science. Because right. Data science, I mean, you know, Tracy, like you're the probably the biggest data scientist out of all of us. Mm-hmm. So do you have any thoughts on decision science in athletes and coaching versus the data science that you do as your day job?
Well, I think the major difference is when it comes to coaching, you're working with an individual. There's like I mentioned earlier, there's so much more of a human element behind it. With big data science, there's no faces, right? It's just you're a row in a spreadsheet, right? There's no human element. And so I think, like Namrita said, when you have the full context, it just allows for so much more richer decision making, really. Like, okay, you know, this is what's going on for this person. This is how their race went. Okay, these data validate their experience, and that's useful. And I think a lot of athletes like to have that additional validation from the research that I've done. And like I mentioned, type A, like data-driven people. But yeah, I think when you're working with a human one-on-one, taking all the variables into consideration is going to like offer a lot more for that athlete than just looking at data alone or, you know, device data alone. It's really limiting.
Yeah. And maybe one more thing we can touch on, you know, while we're considering large versus small amounts of data is, you know, in Epi, one of the things that I've always thought is, you know, you can't really assume a person represents an average, right? And so that's kind of where we're going with this is like, you can get all the large amounts of data you want, but once you get N equals one, this is definitely not N equals 800.
Yeah. Yeah. They could be the outlier or they could be right in the middle of the normal curve. So yeah, that's why it's always like, if you're able to work with somebody one-on-one and take all those other variables into consideration, I think there's going to be a lot more you can offer them than just taking these like standardized data and applying it to, you know, at the athlete who walks through your door.
Yeah. All right. Big data in shambles. You heard it here first. All right. Thank you everybody for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate everybody. Tracy, Namrita, Fabiano. Thank you all. And Tracy, thanks for coming on. I thought you were going to be a good guest and I was absolutely right. Namrita, excellent thanks. As always. Fabiano, excellent as always. All right. Thanks
thank
everybody.
You. Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'd like to thank our guests, Tracy Carson, Namrita Brooke, and Fabiano Araujo, who are all up on the show notes, empiricalcycling.com, under the podcast episodes. You can find contact info. You can get referred to all of the studies that were talked about. They sent me the references, so you can go there and check all that stuff out. And if you would like to get in touch with any of them, I've got their contact information up there as well. So feel free to say hi to all of them. Feel free to ask questions to me or to any of them, although I suggest you refer to them for this episode. If you have any more questions, and of course, I'm happy to put you in touch if you just want to get in touch with me and ask for getting in touch with one of them. And the usual stuff we've got. If you'd like to support the podcast, empiricalcycling.com/donate. We are kept alive with your dollars, kind of like NPR. And of course, if you would like to reach out for coaching, empiricalcycling@gmail.com. And we are always taking on athletes. And if you would like to hire us for a consultation, that's great too. So reach out to the same place. And up on Instagram on the weekend AMAs, and usually we'll do listener questions. Sorry we didn't today, but listener questions up in these stories, and that'll kind of get posted at random, so kind of keep an eye out on that kind of stuff if you really, really want to ask questions of our guests. I will prompt you. I may or may not tell you the guest. And yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. And we'll see you next time.